Revolution, 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 revolution.
Robert Seth Hayes is a father, grandfather, and artist. He is a black revolutionary freedom fighter who was captured and convicted in New York City in 1973 under a host of charges attributed to his membership in the Black Liberation Army, the BLA. Through his conviction, he received 25 years to life. Robert Seth Hayes is one of the hundreds of political prisoners in the U.S. He remains behind bars, and as of July 2002, he is now in his 30th year of incarceration. The following interview was recorded on August 17th, 2002.
Prior to the imprisonment of political prisoner Robert Seth Hayes, he was a member of the Black Panther Party. So I asked him what were some of his specific activities within this group.
When I first involved myself in 1969 in the Black Panther Party, it was to support them economically through the sale and activities of the Black Panther Party newspaper and to participate in community activities such as teach-ins or speak-ins, which we called at that time political education classes. As my involvement in the Black Panther Party grew, what I mean by that is as I stayed on, I was reporting in, I was showing a consistency of being concerned about activities in the community, I was given other responsibilities. Those other responsibilities entailed working for the Black Free Breakfast Program. The Free Breakfast Program was a support network for the community that the Black Panther Party had devised when it felt that due to the nature of the fact that lunch programs had been discontinued in the schools in the black and most of we say third world communities, we felt that children needed a wholesome and healthy meal in preparation before attending classes, because it was our argument that if a child who's only had maybe a cup of coffee and a slice of toast in the morning while sitting in the class about 10 or 11 o'clock is asked if Mary had three apples and she gave one to Johnny and two to Sam, how many would she have left, that the child would not really be thinking about how many apples are left, but how well that apple would taste. And we did not want our children to be, you know, stigmatized into appearing as though they were incapable of understanding simple projects and simple opportunities to solve problems. We created a Black Panther Party free breakfast program that initially, through contributions from the community, which was the Panther Party's objective, was to unite the community and have the United Community Act in terms of a village where everybody shared the entire load for the future, the generations, our children. We would feed them early in the morning. We gave them a complete and wholesome and healthy breakfast and packed them with the wisdom and understanding and the support that they were wonderful and that it was their responsibility and their duty to become educated citizens of their community and return with those skills to uplift and develop their communities. So from newspaper selling to free breakfast program to acting in capacity in our free medical clinics, where we again petition some of the health care providers in our communities to surrender some free time, some pro bono time to assist people. We would go in, and because I had no medical background, so to speak, in the hospitals and in the clinics and in the storefront clinics that we had, my only contribution was janitorial services. So I would go in, I would do a lot of cleaning up and supportive in that respect to give back while they were giving back. And we would talk to people, and we would help people to try to develop an understanding of what the process was, what you were waiting for, how long it might take, and how not to become frustrated. We did what we could to help develop a positive and a correct approach to community development. And those skills were the skills that were applicable during the time of the Black Panther Party that I utilized. Of course, there were other aspects. There were the constant harassments and, you know, the antagonisms and the attacks by, you know, various task forces of, you know, the security elements of America. You know, we were entire scrutiny. And Well, there were a lot of activities that we had to formulate. We had to educate people so that people would be supportive of what was going on in the community. They knew to come out when it was large masses of police operations, when it was safe to do so. If someone was to be arrested, to not necessarily, you know, interfere, because that would be in violation of the law, but to at least observe. And we believe that by our actions and our activities and our educational processes in the Black Panther parties, circumstances like the Rodney King episode were the outcome of those actions, because people began to pay attention and people began to become involved, whereas before they would have thought twice about, well, no, I can't get involved. They were actually involved in, you know, determining their own destiny, as opposed to being told and effectively pigeonholed into an existence according to, you know, the powers that be. That, in essence, I think, was my contribution to the Black Panther Party when I came home in 1969.
I asked Robert Seth Hayes if he could briefly explain what COINTELPRO is.
Well, COINTELPRO is a computer acronym for counterinsurgency program. And this counterinsurgency program identity was primarily an attack mode that was put into place to stymie growth and development in the Black community in terms of leadership towards political empowerment. If you were not a member of the accepted forms of protest, if you were not a member of, say, the NAACP, or if you weren't a member of CORE, then you could not be a member. You could not be a dissident in America. You had to effectively not protest. America, it was felt, had too many skeletons in its closet, and it did not wish any, you know, any scrutiny of its past and its present activities. So in order to protect itself, it began to implement programs that were primarily designed to offset, in the event that something developed, to remove it. And that meant many, many things, from the misrepresentation of the legal aspects of, say, Martin Luther King, to the murdering outright of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. I mean, it just covered all the bases.
I asked Robert Settes, how is his health?
My health. This is like a twofold aspect. I will answer part one now, and I will come back to it again at another time. But primarily, I was diagnosed diabetic in the year 2000, and at the same time, I was informed that I also had antibodies for the infection hepatitis C. The diabetics is what we call adult onset diabetes. I was in my 50s when it just occurred out of the clear blue sky, and I have no history of it in my family, so it was a radical change in my life. When I was diagnosed with diabetes, within a week span of time of being told that, I was informed that I had hepatitis C. And I asked at that time, what was the cure for it? And I was told there was no cure for hepatitis C. That I had nothing to worry about, that it, you know, it takes a long time to come in, it has a long time to incubate, and, you know, and this, that, and the other. And so he said, well, probably, you know, you got it. Did you ever use drugs intravenously? And I told him, no. I said, well, have you ever had a blood transfusion? No. I said, well, let's just face the facts that, you know, probably somewhere in your past, like when you was in the street or something, you was using drugs, and it has an incubation period of anywhere from 15 to 20 years. So, you know, that's probably what it is. So I looked at them and I said, well, excuse me, at this point in time, I've never had drugs in my life. I have no drug history coming into the facility with drugs or having drugs participation inside the facility since I've been here. I've been down 27 years. So where did this stuff come from? It had to come from in here. It could not have come from outside. So therefore, it's the only conclusion I can draw, because I don't shoot drugs, and because the hepatitis C infection is transmitted the same way the AIDS virus transmission is transmitted, that is through intravenous, tattooing, or homosexual contact, blood-to-blood contact, and I've had none of these that I could identify with, I could only conclude that I was given hepatitis C from the state. Some unprofessional healthcare provider, you know, probably inadvertently while, you know, taking blood from somebody, you know, was carrying on dialogue with somebody else, and when I showed up to have my blood checked, it hit me with the same needle that somebody else had. I'm saying it's possibly an error. I'm not saying it was intentional, but by that same token, that's how I came into contact with hepatitis C. So when they realized that it could not have sat by and incubated for 27 years, the fact that it was in its very early stages, that it was only manifesting, that I could not have had this in the street, I had to have had it here. And there was no record of any kind of drug use or embodiment in the whole time I'd been here, so they were stymied. When I found out I had hepatitis C and I began to, you know, solicit, because I had these two infections simultaneously manifesting themselves, I developed a lot of side effects that I was attributing to the diabetes, and they were false readings for things like neuropathy, you know, because I was having symptoms, but it was, I believe today, a combination of both those infections simultaneously. So with the neuropathy, I was requesting, you know, examination by endocrinologist, an expert on nerves. And, of course, the state refused. At that point in time, you know, we knew that Noor was already sick, and Noor had developed cancer, and I was suspicious of that, because Noor had never mentioned that he had cancer. So we were wondering, well, what happened to him? And only to find out later on that they were telling Noor that the reason why he was having all of this pain he was complaining about was that he had diabetes, and that was what was affecting him, until it was almost too late when they discovered, oh, quite by accident, that he had cancer. Now, mind you, they're checking his blood once a month, and when they're checking his blood through the lab reports, they were doing lab work for almost everything. So they knew clearly, early on, exactly what he had. But they waited until it was irreversible before they even acknowledged that he had it to him. And at that point, they had just closed the book on the epitaph, and his obituary was already written. My health, in the same kind of vein, was that they took the absolute time. First, they refused to let me see an endocrinologist. They refused all aspects of me having any kind of liver biopsy to check to see how advanced the liver was deteriorated due to hepatitis C. And they made a big hoop-de-doo of it on the strength that in order for me to have a complete physical examination, I had to first agree to take a program, a drug program, and participate in a drug program for 6 months before I could have this hepatitis C medication or healthcare examination, blah, 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 blah. Well, I refuse. I refuse on the grounds that I have no drugs, I do not deal with drugs, and it just didn't make any sense for me to submerge myself in a drug culture for 6 months to learn all about drugs and how to cut the drugs, how to sniff it, to snort it, and all the things that it would do to you, when I was already of the mind that I did not wish to deal with that. That I live in a reality where people around me every day in population are getting high, but I don't have to be around that. I don't have to dialogue or observe that. I could always move somewhere. The fact that I had no drug history indicated to me that there was no need for it, but only a justification to cook the books. If I signed into this program and then later on tried to contest and argue that they gave this to me, they would say, I do not know what he's talking about. As far as we're concerned, he took this drug program, so obviously he knew there was something there, and so that's the end of that. to withhold my medical treatment on the strength of some stupid program I was willing to sacrifice to say, well, then withhold it, and we'll see what the courts say about you withholding medical treatment. That lasted all of about a year, when they decided that with so many people involved in observing, they were going to give me the liver biopsy. And when they gave it to me, it conformed to the original diagnosis that it was early onset cirrhosis of the liver. It could be treated fairly easily with interferon with an 80% chance of recovery. They took that issue and decided, well, because I wasn't going to take this ASAC program, and they couldn't really go on record as saying that that's why they was refusing it, they gave me the excuse that, well, the pharmaceutical department had not made enough medicine at this date and time, and at this date and time I was on the waiting list to receive this interferon Ribitron cocktail. That lasted all of about 8 months, and then they finally came up with it. I now take Preg Intron, which is an injection once a week, and I take Ribitron 900 milligrams in the morning and 900 milligrams at night, which is an antibiotic. Both of these antibiotics target the liver to kill the cirrhosis and to regenerate the liver. When they gave this to me, they handed me a bunch of pamphlets because they were going to avoid the protocol, you know, the blood checking, the monitoring, all the things that they don't do here for prisoners. We receive no medical attention. And when they laid out the possible side effects for it, it was quite frightening, including suicide tendencies, what they were saying as part of the possibilities that one would go through taking this medication. I took a chance, and I took it. After 6 weeks of taking the medication, I'm thankfully glad to say that I have never had a side effect. I attribute that to the fact that I've never had a drug culture. I've never had an alcoholic culture. I do not drink. I do not get high. You know, I don't participate in those things. So the medication that I've taken, it has weakened me and shortened my endurance ability in some cases. But in most cases, I'm able to just keep moving. I'm exercising, I monitor what I'm eating. Again, the protocol that they should be following, they're not. But I have, since the 6 weeks I've been on it, I've had two blood tests, and I'm waiting for results of that so that I can send that out so that can be reviewed by our medical teams outside to see if I'm really in as good a shape as I feel I am. Because there is no protocol here. Nobody's even questioning what's happening. If I say I haven't had any side effects, you know, they're looking at me surprised-like, but I see no recording of any of this information, which is important because they really need a record in case something turns around. But it's typical, you know. We're forced to do this. We're giving you the meds, and we don't like it. We would rather not do it, but you have it, and then that's the end of that. So you really have to be on top of your health care. It's just no help anyplace else.
On July 17th, 2002, Robert Seth Hayes came up for parole for the third time, and he was denied again. So I asked him if he could explain on what grounds he was denied.
For the third time, consistently, I was denied parole for 24 months for seriousness of the crime, criminal history, and a preponderance for violence. Let me explain what that means. This was the decision as they wrote it out. What they said was, because that I was charged with a host of crimes, including attempted murder, possession of a weapon, and blase, as a member of the BLA 29 years ago, because of that fact, that gave them the right to say that I have a propensity for violence. Further, that I have a criminal history. Well, the only problem with that, or with both of those, is for the 29 years that I've been down, I have no new charges, in and including assault on staff or assault on inmate or assault on anybody else. So how they conclude preponderance of violence is beyond my capabilities to understand. A criminal history, as they have defined it, Again, I have no charges. The only criminal history I've ever had is this charge that I got busted on 29 years ago. I've never been in prison in my life. So when they talk about a criminal history, what history are they talking about? In light of those two facts, the courts have ruled consistently from 1991 to the year as early as 2001 that you cannot hit on the nature of the crime, that you have to have mitigating circumstances to substantiate that hit, because the nature of the crime is never going to change. What you were convicted of, say, 50 years ago, 50 years later will be the same thing you were convicted of. It's never going to change. So, when it came to me, the mitigating circumstances they would need is an assault, even something as simplistic as a dirty urine for taking drugs, because that would indicate that I'm not really taking this seriously, I'm committing crime and violating the rules and regulations as I go, and so on and so on and so on. What we are being hit by is what happened to Jaleel Anthony Bottom, my co-defendant, is that as they did a strong propaganda decision-making, public opinion, hair-raising, fiery rhetorical campaign, was that they stated he's a cop killer and 30 years is not enough. What that expresses is public opinion. But these are public officials, including the mayor, Mayor Bloomberg of New York City, who also wrote the parole board. These are public officials giving the authority in the public eye to carry out certain manifestations of the law, should know the law, that the Supreme Court has heard these arguments since 1991. And the Supreme Court, in Supreme Court language, has stated emphatically, being a cop killer does not mean de facto you do not get parole. You cannot use that to render public opinion and allow it or try to enforce it to supersede Supreme Court law is a violation of the law itself. The law has been emphatically clear, but the parole boards are attempting to blindside the law by exerting its mandate, its, shall we say, hidden agenda, which is in violation of the law. We, in our appeals, must bring to the public's attention that this is taxation without representation. If we are to pay taxes, then we should receive the rights under the law as is written within the law, and not be denied the law simply because America wishes to hide its political prisoner activities. By criminalizing us and claiming that as criminals we are removed from political prisoner status, but by the same token, because we're political prisoners, that we don't receive the rights of those who are criminally confined, is a complete circle of contradictions, that is a contradiction upon itself. Either we're criminals or we're political prisoners, or we're political prisoners and we're not criminals. But this is something that, even if we are unable to free ourselves, we will have at least generated an educational process for those who come behind us to have the tools in which to fight the future fight that is to come.
And so I asked Robert Seth Hayes if he was planning to appeal this decision. Here is his answer.
Absolutely. And I've just come across more and more and more new information that gives a whole new slant on things. In the past, we were basically attacking the parole division because there was belief in our part that they were the initiators of these kinds of stupidities that we were undergoing and violations of the law, when lo and behold, we've discovered a whole new nest of vipers. And these vipers have been manipulating the law, violating the law, and because they were hidden, weren't being held accountable for the law, they have been given the responsibility to uphold. Now that they're out in the open, we're going to target them and the parole board, and we're going to start to make some serious demands that no taxation without representation. We will think about suggesting civil disobedience or many other factors inside the community so that the community's decisions and its powers or its empowerment is recognized, and that those who uphold the law and authority and given a mandate by the people will realize that they're subject to the will of the people and not to their class position.
I asked Robert Seth Hayes what he could tell us in regards to the New York Police Department's terrorist task force.
Other than the fact that it was at one time a mere wing of intelligence that was designed to act as a covert military police force, to this day has broadened itself to the point that now there are basically a paramilitary, what we would call a right-wing terrorist force. When you look at the examples in El Salvador or Nicaragua or Colombia, you see these right-wing militias that go around and carry out assassinations and kidnappings and intimidations, and every now and then a slap on its back as a responsible entity when they make a major, major bust. And that is what, you know, in brief, is the New York State Terror Task Force. It was aptly named. It has carried out this covert war of attrition by trying to disrupt any emerging intelligence, consciousness raising, and or economic or political support that it can muster. And it has many, many heads, like the Hydra head, and it uses all of those. What we need to do is we need to photograph it, document it, you know, and expose it. And I believe these things are being checked and challenged on a continuous basis, because at this date and time, with so much catastrophe around the world, there is just no shadows in which to hide. People have to be very outspoken and open with their illegalities, such as the case of Mayor Bloomberg of New York City. When I mentioned that he is a public official, he's holding a high-ranking office, should he not know law? Should he be responsible to know that the office in which he delegates law from, he should be equipped to at least know the law? For this man to write to the parole board and say that on behalf of somebody else, not for myself, but on behalf of somebody else, I wish to state that this man should not be received parole because he's a cop killer. It's a direct violation of the law. The law says you may not do that. As a commissioner, you may not hit a person because he's a cop killer, solely because he's a cop killer. So what? What's the difference between if he was a grocery store owner? Does that mean that the man would be acquitted if he killed the grocery store owner or a grandmother, and that would be it? Because if he satisfied the initial aspect of the law, then that's it? He's entitled to a second chance, but if it's the police, what is the police? What roles have they played? And when we expect the 28 murders and deaths of supporters and political prisoners over the years, which no one has ever been brought to trial with or convicted of, then you know you're asking a real lot of the public who pay taxes every day to support an elitist regiment of military God knows what. I mean, these people here, they glorify in slogans like the blue wall when somebody commits a heinous crime and nobody tells. They had a blue wall when Abner Nwema was taken into a bathroom, and because he was Haitian, and they said, well, he's not really a member of the New York community here, probably nobody understands what he says, they took a broomstick and broke it up and took pleasures and shoved it up his rectum. They thought that was hilarious, to humiliate a grown man to the point that he had no human rights as far as they were dealing with an animal and they could take these liberties with. But when it came out that this very act had occurred, there was what they called the blue wall. And they got away with that. They got away with that because those who kept the wall intact are still out there carrying themselves off, flaunting themselves off as heroes today.
Earlier in the interview, Robert Seth Hayes had mentioned a comrade of his, Albert Noah Washington, a fellow member of the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army, and also later a political prisoner. Noah died in April of 2000 while imprisoned in New York State. He had cancer, which was very late in being diagnosed. In one of the last interviews he did before he died,